wearing masks, etc. And these people get away with it. We have a few concerns. We found that the re-evaluation of persons on disability grants could not take place due to staff shortages. This means that the burden of households rests solely on the shoulders of older persons in whose care these people are often left while parents are working or occupied elsewhere. We recommend that the DSD interact with YALS to facilitate a process whereby we can overcome this obstacle. Also, people in receipt of social assistance do not qualify for food hampers, but it is precisely these responsible persons that keep the household going. It also seems that hampers do not always land at the most needed spots. It is important to know that older persons who are vulnerable put themselves at risk to keep our community stable out of a duty of care, although it is not their responsibility. As soon as we became aware of the pandemic outbreak, the board of the WCOPF cancelled all scheduled meetings and advised all members to close service centres and cease all club activities until further notice. We also asked service centres to donate all perishable foods to soup kitchens or to underprivileged community members to avoid wastage or in case food went bad. Board members in the various regions started operating feeding schemes for older persons and children as well as unemployed community members. Some of the board members are currently still engaged in these activities, especially in the Metro, Cape Metro. The WCOPF Board of Directors are holding virtual meetings and is in the process of building the capacity of regional forum members to do likewise. The WCOPF will support the regional forums with their virtual meetings as far as possible. The WCOPF intends to actively seek funding in order to reproduce 1,000 booklets of the COVID-19 protocol manual for distribution throughout the Western Cape, especially in the rural areas. We seek funding in order for the 1,000 hygiene packs, buckets consisting of the following items. And there we have a 10-liter white bucket, 2 cloth masks, 6 sunlight soap bars, 2 bottles of bleach, 100-millimeter sanitizer, and the information pamphlet. The intention is to distribute these hygiene packs or buckets together with the protocol manual. Partners have already been identified and approached in this regard. A few recommendations: the training of all staff regarding COVID-19, making funding available for proper PPEs, counseling or debriefing sessions for staff members, regular information sessions to residents regarding COVID-19, home-based carers who are at home due to the lockdown could be utilized to assist in residential facilities in their areas. Intersectoral collaboration will be the key to all challenges and beneficial to all older persons. In closing, COVID-19 did not cause the challenges faced by older persons on a daily basis. However, it has caught us unaware and unprepared. We should all learn from this. It has, however, highlighted the inequalities and shortfalls and ensure that we are not taken by surprise ever again. Taking older person issues to heart become the new normal. We should encourage younger people to become more involved with older persons and in so doing, bridge the generation gap. I thank you for your kind consideration. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Hendricks. You managed that expertly, as if you've done this sort of video conferencing many, many times before, so well done. We're now then going to move to Age and Action Western Cape. I believe we have Ms. Irene Snell-Carroll on the line. Ms. Snell Carroll, are you on the line? She's the Provincial Director of Age and Action Western Cape.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you, thank you. If I could just ask Mr. Hendricks to unshare your presentation, please. Ms. Snell Carroll, do you have a presentation or are you going to speak to us orally, verbally?
I do have a presentation. Let me just get to it. Sorry. Can you see my presentation?
Yes, we can. Thank you very much. Please proceed.
Okay. Thank you. I'm going to move quickly. I'm going to skip the front part about the organization, etc., and get right to what needs to be discussed. So Western Cape operates in the whole Western Cape area, and we have three offices, which is the one is based in Cape Town and the one in George, and then we have another office in Lambert Bay. We're 14 staff members, with 6 social workers and 5 auxiliary workers. So that is our staff component. I'm not going into what we actually have done and straight to the older persons and COVID-19. COVID-19 has shaken our foundations and lifestyles every day, particularly the older persons. And we know it's very frightening and threatening to the lives of older persons, which involve their safety. And they cannot, as per norm, operate as they used to in the community. The fear of the unknown is very difficult for the older persons to deal with. Nobody knows if it's ever going to end, and this is particular struggle for the older persons to come to terms with the new routine. And social distancing is crucial, but it needs to be accompanied by social support and measures and target care for the older person, increasing the access to digital technology as well. So what we've done during this lockdown specifically is providing information to the older person, which is very, very important for them. We try to make the resources available, tell them where to get what, how to do, and how to operate. Essential supplies, where they could, it was very difficult, specifically in the beginning of this lockdown, because a lot of the people like masks and sanitizer, which was almost non-existent or not available for a lot of the older person, and which was very difficult. Emergency fund numbers and etc. has been given to the older person. This has been done all via telephonically, follow up specifically with our members and member organizations, give them all the information via email. Those who have email, we could give that to them. The important was thing for them is to what to understand that they used to specifically a primary caregiver, but if that person should fall in sick, what is the next step, and that they have a plan B in place to follow up and somebody who can take care of them. So we made a few food parcels available and masks, which ran out very quickly because the need was so high in specifically those or the calls that we get from rural areas where there's mostly seasonal workers, people or children that are doing that, and suddenly they couldn't even work, and that was also a challenge. Important to identify the older persons that that is living alone, and we support them through our client base. Our social workers call them and assure them of if they the loneliness and that we're there if they need to follow up. Counseling service was very difficult for both our staff members and social workers and our auxiliary workers, but however, they try to remain very professional, because the one time maybe you speak to one person and the next time the social worker will follow up and that person won't be there anymore. Bereavement support was given, a specific transport for older persons that need to go out was provided by some of our member organizations, but it soon becomes very expensive because they too afraid to travel in taxis, those who could go and have no other option but to go. The organization, the members only provide lunches, they try to, and with our elderly care drive, we could have managed to get assistance and supplies that we further that, and we currently also busy following up in terms of a survey that we busy with to determine what more how we can assist them further. Challenges, under normal circumstances, we know that it's very difficult living the minimal that they need to live with, but now even with the pandemic, it put a further strain on them. And then older persons have to stretch their pension to assist children who have lost their job, working full time, and also still have to pay their normal bills. Communication, we find also that lack of understanding and communication, the language barrier, that people don't have the information in their particular language, which was difficult. We also found that low literacy level from or some of the older persons, which they have to now assist their grandchildren maybe with schoolwork and activities, and that remains a challenge because their parent is working and they have to see and that they do, but some of them can't even do that. The 24-hour support system, the older person being the 24-hour support for frontline workers, for their children, and it's taking a toll on the older persons because they themselves get burned out because they're not used to the 24-hour taking care of children or grandchildren. Older persons cannot come to terms with the loss of loved ones because of this, they couldn't say their proper farewell maybe to a loved one, and this creates it's very traumatizing for them. And then aspect is important to a lot of the older person. They very frustrated that they some do understand, others don't, that they can't go to the normal worship place of worship. Getting chronic medication is also for them a challenge, and they don't. Some of them don't have people that they can even send to pick up the medication for them. Many older persons thrive on social interaction because for a lot of them that is the only interaction they get during the day, and now suddenly be cut off. Create a risk of falling into depression and also leave them traumatized. The report of elder abuse cases, interesting, did not spike as significantly as we expected, but the reason could be that the fear of older persons living 24/7 now with the perpetrator also realized they had no other place to go and no privacy to talk because they're living together 24/7. And the fact that money is more going to the food on the table than airtime talking and sorting their problems out. So, and social distancing, self-isolation is extremely difficult, as we know. People that live in informal settlements and in low-cost housing, where people, even five and more, are living in one bedroom. People taking advantage of older persons who are so trustworthy. So they being abused. In conclusion, older persons are frequently overlooking development and humanitarian strategy development and funding in the context of COVID-19 and the risk posed to older persons. They must be explicitly identified and considered in funding applications and decisions at all levels and all settings. I thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Irene Snell-Carroll, for those inputs. We're then going to move on to the Cape Peninsula Organization for the Aged. We have Sister Louise Nix on the line, who I believe is going to be doing a brief oral submission to the committee. Sister Nix, are you on the line?
Hi, can you hear us?
Yes, very well.
Okay, I'm Louise Nix from the CPOA. I have my colleague here, Yolanda Adams, who is the HR manager. And we just thought we'd give you an overview of our experiences amongst our company. So I do have a presentation and we're going to show it now.
Thank you.
Are you seeing it? Do you have it on your screen?
Not yet. Sometimes just takes a few seconds. Nope.
Not yet.
We're clicking on the share play.
There we go.
Okay. Have we got you?
Yes.
All right. Okay, great. All right. So I just want to give you a brief introduction to CPOA. We are a nonprofit organization which was founded over 65 years ago to provide accommodation to those retirees that didn't have the funds at the time to retire in a safe environment and to care for themselves in the golden years. We've obviously grown since then, and we do have more economic homes, but we also have a very strong welfare commitment. We own 17 independent living facilities, as well as 12 care centers, and 6 of those are welfare homes. And ultimately, we are responsible for over 2,200 lives. Just wanted to explain our staff complement as well. We have about 311 in-house staff. Our outsourced staff comprises of 965, so our total staff complement is 1,276. So ultimately, you know, looking at our stats, we were looking at the residents as well as the staff that were working with the residents.
Okay, and in preparing for COVID, COVID is and has been uncharted territory for everyone because we found ourselves having to navigate through uncharted territory. We put together a COVID strategy team consisting of senior management. Prior to going into lockdown, the COVID strategy team met every morning at 8:30, and it was during these meetings that we formulated our COVID strategy. We drafted our COVID policies in line with government gazettes published at the time and conducted risk assessments for both our homes and head office. Truthfully, during the initial stages, the task felt very daunting. However, we stayed committed to keeping ourselves informed of any changes or developments. We discussed everything COVID-related as a team and often debated many points. We also stayed committed to keeping the rest of our management teams and staff informed every step of the way by communicating and sharing all COVID policies with them, by educating them on COVID through daily mailers and displayed posters, and also ensuring that each and every staff member was issued with an essential services work permit. We bought and issued each staff member with two masks prior to this becoming mandatory. We purchased additional PPE, such as screens, dividers, and sanitizer stations prior to this becoming mandatory. We implemented a 7-day on and 7-day off sleep-in shift system for our homes. We provided staff transport for head office staff, and we've continued to do this as the levels have become more relaxed. Choosing to keep the staff transport at 70% occupancy instead of the now allowed 100% occupancy. As the levels became more relaxed, we used the phased-in work week approach for head office staff, and the rest of the time, staff who are able to, they work remotely. As the levels have progressed, the COVID strategy team continued to meet daily via Zoom, and we used these sessions to adjust our strategy as and when needed.
Okay, so I'm just going to discuss the first case that we had of COVID. It was a huge learning curve for us, and I think that we were probably the first old age home in the Western Cape to have a positive case. It occurred in an economic home in Hart Bay. We traced back, it could have been either an independent resident that brought in the virus or a staff member, but that's really irrelevant. But it was just an interesting dynamic. At that point, you know, it was all so new to all of us, and we called on the Department of Health, and they did come and assist us. They set up a testing station, and they assisted in testing the staff and the contacts. At that point, we also realized that we had to mobilize additional PPE, and with our team and the management team, we interestingly devised this plastic gown that I've got a picture of. This was the prototype, but it's got long sleeves, and it is disposable. So that has been really helpful for giving to the staff when they go in and out of a positive patient's room. Again, it was a huge learning curve. Now we had positive cases, we had to implement certain policies. Questions arose that if a resident went to hospital, what was the procedure going to be when they returned to the home? And these are all things that we had to learn and we had to implement. So it was difficult learning, but it was great learning as well. We also decided that we were going to test all the residents in the care center, and then one day we would test them, and then a couple of days later, someone that tested negative started showing symptoms again, so we then retested again. And we kind of realized at this point that we were just chasing our tail, testing and retesting and testing and retesting. So we realized that we had to come up perhaps with a different strategy, because as the crisis escalated, so did the return time on the test results. Initially, I think some we even got back within 24 hours, but later on in the crisis, it was taking over a week to get the results back. So then we decided at management level that perhaps the best thing would be to open an absolute quarantine unit, not just isolate the cases on site within a care center, and we went ahead and did that. So we identified two places where they are isolated within the care center, the two units being Trinon in Deep River to serve the economic residents, and then Lotus River in the welfare sector. And we arranged for one of our CPNs, who was greatly trained and qualified with a great wealth of experience, to go in and assist with these opening of the quarantine units. There was significant staff training, and we're not just talking about the PPE and the gowning. There was things that we had to implement, like how are we going to deliver meals to these residents? How are we going to clean the crockery that the residents had used? All those intricate things, the linen, the medication control. We also had to designate specific cleaners into the units as well, that also had to be trained with the relevant PPE. We also had to ensure that staff that were working in the quarantine units didn't come into contact with staff that were working in the care center. And they were sleeping in at the time to also help with decreasing the spread of the virus. So we had to have separate sleeping quarters for them and encourage and ensure social distancing at lunch times and at break times. Just as a general management within the home, within the normal care setting, we have obviously daily activities for our residents, and we had to change the kind of thought around that. They couldn't share things, they couldn't share dominoes or things like cards, so there was no sharing of equipment. We had to ensure social distancing at mealtimes, and this was managed. We had to manage them in smaller groups, and I've just shown you an example of a physio exercise class at one of the welfare homes where they had to do it outside in the beautiful weather, and they were practicing social distancing. As far as managing the residents goes, we had to keep in constant communication with them. You know, the managers would speak to them, the managers would send out letters, and then top management would send out letters on a regular basis. The homes were in total lockdown, and we weren't allowing visitors. And I must say that this has been one of the biggest challenges we've had at management level, because the significant others weren't able to see what was happening with their family members. We encourage FaceTime calls and WhatsApp calls, but it still remains a big challenge to us. We are considering no contact visits, whereby you could perhaps have a booth with a plastic separation. And so we're busy planning for that. Obviously, constant resident education, just to let them know what is happening and why we're making the decisions that we were making. Support from Department of Health and Department of Social Development, just assisting us with the correct things to communicate with the residents. And as Yolanda mentioned, initially all non-essential staff had to remain at home. Just a brief outlook at our stats, a brief overview of our stats. The average age of our CPOA resident is 82 years, and then if you compare it to the South African stats, it's 28 years old. Our infection rate was at 7.3%. Our recovery rate was 76.25%. Of the residents only, because those stats are indicative of both residents and staff, the mortality rate of our residents was 1.43% and positive residents at 19.6%. And this is compared to the USA stats of their elders at 42%. So the recovery rate really shows that we have managed to contain and treat the virus. Just looking at our quarantine unit stats, Trianon was able to have 19 residents in at one time, and Lotus catered for 43 at a time. You can see here that there were a significant amount of recoveries and mortalities, and Trianon was 6 and at Lotus River was 7. And you can just see the average age. We're also very proud to say that I think we have the oldest survivor of COVID-19 in the Western Cape. He's 92 years old and was interviewed by the Western Cape government. You might have seen his post on Facebook. And we've also had recoveries of residents with comorbidities, for example, diabetics. I'd just like to mention that at present, the quarantine units are empty. We do not have any residents in the quarantine units at the moment.
Okay, and then to support our staff, importantly, we acknowledge that without our valued staff members, we would not be able to navigate our way through these trying times. So we are continuously striving to support our staff in any way that we can. We encourage our staff to embrace our new normal, and we strive daily to lead by example. We've had weekly Zoom meetings with our nursing and home managers to touch base, but also allow them to discuss challenges, frustrations, and share any victories of their homes or for their homes. We've employed the services of a life coach who has conducted coaching workshops with our managers. During these sessions, our managers were able to unpack any challenges they've experienced due to COVID, determining which challenges were within their control, and then brainstorming to find solutions to those challenges. We've also strongly encouraged our staff to take time out to focus on their mental and emotional well-being. And last but not least, we've reached out for donations, which has helped us put together food parcels and purchase food vouchers, which we will be distributing to staff members who are in need in the next couple of days.
wrap up to this and the learnings. I think right from the beginning, we were moving with a we were dealing with a constantly moving target. There was no absolute prescription, and as days passed, our policies could actually change, you know, on a weekly basis. We were very focused as a team and supported greatly by management. We also had a lot of sharing experiences. We offered support and ideas, and what worked in one home, we passed on to another home. We also realized that the virus did not pick and choose who it wanted to infect. It's not about age or anything like that. Everybody, you know, can get the virus. Anybody can. I think the immediate intervention to isolate suspected cases appears to have helped us in combating this war. And the constant training and reminder about PPE usage, and also the communication levels between staff, other departments, and internally at head office was also a great learning. Just would like to also thank DSD and DOH for their assistance supplying us with PPE as well as information. They were always readily available to help, and I'd just like to thank you, those departments, for their support. So we have managed to flatten the curve at CPOA. We are cautious of a second wave, but we are certainly prepared. I'd like to thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you both very much for having prepared that very comprehensive presentation. We're now going to move on to RCFFIA. I believe we have Mrs. Mara Korenhoff, who's the Vice Chairperson, on the line, who's going to give a brief verbal input. Is that correct?
No, it's Lucia Smuts. I'm the person responsible for the older persons.
Thank you, Mrs. Smuts. Please proceed. Welcome.
Thank you. Can everybody hear me?
Yes, we can hear you. Thank you.
The older person teams of the RCPF mother body have empowered themselves from the start of this COVID-19 with the necessary knowledge and regarding this virus. We used the information that was available from the World Health Organization, our governmental organizations like DSD and DOH, and other role players. Through this whole process, everybody involved attend seminars and webinars and meetings and liaise with colleagues in the sector for older persons. The RCFF has used their own policies and procedures, specifically the Occupational Health and Safety Manual and the Infection Prevention and Control Policy. We've amended these policies to prepare ourselves to address and combat the COVID-19 pandemic. From the start of the pandemic, the management at the facilities established an action or emergency committee, which consists of representatives from the management board, the staff, community leaders, medical professions, to address these policies and procedures in the workplace and make quick decisions on short notice. RCPF addressed the issue of staff coming into facilities for work. Some of the staff volunteered to sleep in where infrastructure was available to do so. Staff was prepared to stay in instead of staying in possible high-risk communities and using taxi services which did not accommodate the necessary physical distances from each other. The residents were not allowed to receive visits during the lockdown, and that helped us to prevent the spread of COVID-19. All gifts and parcels were sanitized before it was given to the residents. The screening of all our staff is an ongoing procedure. Staff is coming to work in their private clothing. They change into uniforms at work, and some of the facilities was possible to provide transport to their staff to prevent the spread of the virus. The sharing of information regarding the definition of a close contact was something that really helped us a lot. That 1.5 meter from each other, not longer than 15 minutes in communication, is still an excellent tool to determine the tracing of the virus in the facilities and help the action committees to amend the procedures. The mandatory wearing of the mask and screening of all staff and residents assist with prevention of the spread of the virus. The managers couldn't work in isolation where certain services in the facilities are sourced out, and like the catering, cleaning, and in some places the care services. This is a mutual effort to implement protocol to prevent the spread of the virus. Some of the challenges that we've encountered as far during this pandemic was the pandemic arrived after the budgets were approved. One of the huge challenges was to adapt to the budgets for COVID-19 expenses. The affordability and the availability of proper PPE for the staff, which includes that required N95 masks, remains a challenge. Some other challenges included not being able to fill empty beds immediately. Furthermore, relief staff were absorbed by other places in our industry and therefore unable to replace our own staff who tested positive and were placed in isolation. Staff who used public transport decided to use private taxis to prevent infection. As a result, additional costs influenced the individual's net income. The large number of tests done and the waiting period for the results for residents and staff caused a delay in the implementation of further preventative measures. The running cost of facilities increased by the day. Family co-payments stopped when some relatives lost their jobs. This caused huge pressure on the management. Due to lockdown, volunteers was not possible to enter the facilities and render their services. Fundraising at facilities came to a total standstill. To share our experiences, we are very grateful for the enormous contribution of local medical experts and clinics, their inputs to support our nursing staff. One of the approaches of the RCVF is transparency. Management frequently updated employees, residents, and relatives through newsletters, emails, and phone calls. This lowered the anxiety levels. Staff who were tested positive and isolated at government isolation facilities instead of their own homes gave an excellent feedback on the treatment they've received there. Residents who tested positive and had to comorbidities was taken care of at these facilities as far as possible, instead of being admitted to a hospital. Staying in a well-known environment helped the residents with recovery. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Ms. Smuts, for your inputs. We're very grateful for them. We then move on to the final presentation for this portion of the meeting, which is from the Western Cape Association for Persons with Disabilities. I'm not sure who's going to be leading the presentation. Is it you, Ms. Schrobler?
No, our liaison officer, Erica de Toy, is going to do that first.
Thank you, Ms. Schrobler. Mr. Toy, thank you very much. Please proceed. I think you're on mute.
There we go. Can everyone hear me now?
Yes, loud and clear. Thank you.
Brilliant. Okay. Thank you very much for inviting us to do a presentation, specifically around our response to COVID-19 amongst our beneficiaries, which are, of course, persons with disabilities. I think what we've heard is that most organizations experienced a similar situation to us in that there was very little time available to put any kind of preparation in place, and not only in terms of our services, but for the effect that it would have on the lives and the livelihoods of persons with disabilities, as well as our services. So in compliance with government regulations, we issued the instruction that all our branches and projects close on the 26th of March. During that initial three-week lockdown, all services closed down, but then after that, social workers were deemed an essential service, which they hadn't up until then, and our social workers were able to return to the office or at least return to work remotely. As a provincial office, we did not open our offices as we don't render a direct services to persons with disabilities, and we would not have received the necessary permits for traveling. But we continued with all support and guidance services remotely as we do normally during pre-lockdown. So in terms of our support to our branches, which is our main function, our branches provide that direct service, and our purpose is to support them and ensure that they can do so. The consequence of the closure was that income dropped dramatically as the branches were no longer permitted to arrange fundraising activities, and nor was there any income from special care centre fees, which are nominal at best, or sale of products made in protective workshops. We needed a clear understanding of how we'd go about dealing with the situation, so our social work team brainstormed and wrote our strategy. And then they were in constant supervision, constant communication with our branches, of which there are 27 across the Western Cape, so it's quite a large number. They, as I said, constant communication regarding regulations, any changes in the regulations. They provided guidance and support two branches around essential services, and also the strategic reopening of other services like the special care centres and the workshops. So our support included the continued supervision towards social workers, which is a function that we do ordinarily, but because of the pandemic, it was extremely heightened. And that was to ensure that services continued to the vulnerable group that we served, but also to ensure that social workers received psychosocial support in the emotionally demanding period that we are currently going through. There was daily contact during lockdown, there still is, to ensure that branches complied with the Disaster Management Act and followed the guidelines and protocol for reopening. We were able to distribute 180 boxes of nappies plus 60 packets, which came to a total of 20,000 nappies. And this was an allocation from our national body, the National Council of and for Persons with Disabilities. It's an annual project, and we were fortunate to have that happen just after lockdown. So initially we were not able to get the nappies down from Johannesburg until the lockdown was eased a little bit. So that was absolutely great. And you can see, I'm just showing a few photos of those nappies reaching the people that they need to reach. We also did distribution of the PPE equipment, which included masks, shields and gloves to branches, and we provided online training in the correct use of this equipment. We also developed a home stimulation program for children together with the Department of Basic Education. These are children that would normally have been in the special care center, but could obviously not be there because it was closed. And then we were able to distribute a lump sum of our own funding amongst all our branches to assist with their continued operational costs. And then we planned and prepared for the reopening, which is important for combating isolation, as we've heard in other organizations, and developing the social skills of both children and adults. In terms of awareness, we found that the media focused strongly on the general public. So we turned to radio and social media to highlight the effect that COVID-19 was having on persons with disabilities and our service delivery. So we also shared information from SASA, as many of our beneficiaries are grant recipients. And this caused, obviously, many people contacting us directly with queries about their disability grant, which we could answer, but we couldn't do anything about it because obviously that comes directly from SASA. SASA themselves were inundated and their contact number was completely clogged with calls, particularly once the extended lockdown was announced and people turned to us for help. I don't think even SASA realized exactly what the extent of the need would be. We also gave recognition to donors and thanked them publicly on our social media. Distribution of food parcels to vulnerable households in different communities in the Western Cape were done in partnership with the Mama's Fund, Siemens, and Solidarity, to whom we owe our grateful thanks. There are some of the branches which did partner with local communities, local churches, local ladies groups, but yeah. In terms of branch services, for the purposes of this presentation, we received information from 13 of our branches, which is roughly 50%. And of that 13, four of them either are or have a special care center. Five of them either are workshops or have a workshop, protective workshop, as part of their service delivery. And 10 of them provide a social work service. So if we look at the social work services specifically, we view it obviously as an essential service, but it wasn't recognized in that initial lockdown period. and social workers were unable to continue seeing their clients. But there remained a need for support. So social workers provided a telephonic service where possible. Under lockdown level 4, social workers began providing essential services, which would be home visits, office visits, in other words, visits where a client would be able to come to the social worker's office, and the intake of new clients. And those were under extremely controlled conditions. They did not perform any community work or any group work because of the restrictions. Branches with social services mostly opened on around the 4th of May, with mainly social workers returning and other staff returning only on a rotational basis if necessary, otherwise working remotely. 11 of the 13 branches who responded provided social relief using donations received or partnerships formed with other organizations and churches. A few used their own resources as well as subsidies from both the Departments of Health and Social Development, who gave permission for such deviations. So one of the previous presenters also said that the budgets had already been closed, we'd already received funding, and suddenly there was this huge extra need. So we needed to approach the departments for permission to use what we'd previously applied for this new purpose. And so you can see one of the areas that we deal with is Stellenbosch, and they provide services in Clutersville, Makassar, Kayamandi, and Groendal. Groendal is in Franschhoek, but they cover that whole area, and they did lots of food parcels and distribution of masks. In Mossel Bay, we got tremendous support from the community, donations of foodstuffs, which were then we were able to cook up into meals and distribute food parcels depending on the donation. And there were 4 or so communities around Mossel Bay. Oatsuren as well, we made up food parcels either with own funding distributed to people who either could not get their SASSA grant because it had been it could not be reviewed during the time of that previous lockdown. And then in Overstrand, also the same story, lots of food parcels. All of these areas also did get nappies from the nappy run. And that we find is a tremendous drain on resources. Having to purchase nappies is hugely expensive, we all know. And someone with a disability who needs nappies needs it for an extended period of time. So it's a tremendous help having that donation there. So in terms of social services, these are the statistics that those 13 branches gave us. Remember, 10 of them only provide a social service. So to start with, there were 592 food parcels, which provided food for 1,021 people. 320 cooked meals helped 885 people. And then there were distributions of vouchers. Some of the donors gave us shopping vouchers, and they were able to then pass those on to beneficiaries. Masks and then donations of food.
You've got 2 minutes left, thank you.
Okay, I'll move right along. The special care centres began opening in the middle of April already, again, with hugely, hugely stringent protocols around the regulations. I think what I want to highlight here is the home stimulation programs that was put in place, and staff came to the centre, got everything running, were putting them into flip files and sending them home with the children. I won't go into this anymore because this is the special care centres, but effectively it covers 240 children. The same goes for the services to protective workshops. They opened roughly in the middle of July, also They got donations. This particular one is from the Sand Parks to a place in Heart Bay. George APD was making masks, I think they still are, and selling them as a means of income. And then they managed to get a local donation to help with sanitizing of their offices. Challenges, obviously it had an impact on clients' socioeconomic situation and devastating in terms of our own service delivery, the extended lockdown. Work stability of employees and general well-being of people with disabilities was crucial. Delivering food parcels is not our core business, but the pandemic caused branches to implement these services in order to alleviate the desperate need for social relief, which obviously is a result of the pandemic. And the fact that no funds could be raised during the beginning of lockdown and caused branches to experience huge deficits in their budgets. Corporates could not continue to fund or make donations for their own financial restricted reasons, and branches are now fully dependent on subsidies, which do not provide sufficient funding for all those expenses. And then the unemployment rate increased as branches do not have the resources to pay unfunded salaries, and retrenchment processes have started at some branches. So that's a very brief overview of what we have done in terms of the pandemic and what we will continue to do. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Ms. Dutoy. So that concludes the presentations and inputs for this part of the meeting. It's absolutely remarkable, the work that has been done by these organizations. And I want to say thank you very much for all that you're doing for protecting the most vulnerable in our society. I'm sure the members of the committee might have some inputs or questions, so we will run it in our usual way. I'll ask each party for their questions together. We have four parties present today, so if those organizations would just take note of the questions, and we will then have the answer session once all parties have managed to ask their questions. Each party will receive 3 minutes for this round. Honourable Dagmore, is that a point of order?
No, Chair, I just wanted to clarify, and you did clarify, that there would be 3 minutes available for each party. So in other words, if I use a minute, there would still be 2 minutes left for other members. Thanks.
Correct. Okay, so we'll start with the DA. Are there any inputs or questions from the DA, please?
Yes, Chairperson. Gillian Bosman here.
Thank you. Honourable Bosman, please proceed.
Chair, I just want to direct my question, and firstly, let me start off by saying thank you again to all the organizations for the work, and certainly I want to invite a lot of the organizations in future to engage also with the Standing Committee on Social Development outside of the COVID period, because I think a lot of the issues that have been raised spans beyond just the pandemic. But my question to the organizations I'm representing older persons is, if there has been statistics collected on the impact that the cut out of in-person visits have had on the mental well-being of the residents, if they've got those statistics, and perhaps if they can give us some clear recommendations on what type of programs we can advocate and support for to provide simulation. And then for the organizations.
Honourable Bosman, I'm sorry, I'm pausing your time here. I neglected to mention that although your question could relate to other organisations that assist older persons, specifically the Western Cape Older Persons Forum had to leave the meeting. So if there are any questions for that particular organisation, we can put them in writing after the meeting. My apologies for having interrupted. Please continue.
No, that's fine, Chairperson. I'll move on then. Just the question around specifically support provided for persons with disabilities. I was wondering if there are any specific statistics of how many people are struggling to access their disability grants through SASSA, and specifically how many people have come to these organizations asking for assistance in getting the temporary disability grant renewed, because we know that there's been widespread challenges with SASSA issuing these grants, and there's been no extension of the ministerial directive to accommodate the months of August and September. So if they could provide us with the experiences of applying for that disability grant. and also whether they have received any evidence of SASSA officials referring persons with disabilities to apply for the 350 Rand relief of distress grant. I leave my input there, Chairperson.
Thank you very much. If there are no further inputs from the DA, I now recognize the ANC.
Thank you, Chair. I'll just use a minute also to join Member Bosman in thanking everyone who's made presentations. Firstly, I would like to ask all the organizations who presented whether they received any additional funding from the Provincial Department of Social Development during this period. So if every organization could just indicate that whether they received any additional funding during the period of the lockdown and what was the extent of that funding. And then secondly, one or two of the presentations indicated that there were challenges with masks. I would just like to ask whether there are currently in any of the facilities that have been talked about, any of the organizations, whether there's a shortage of masks at the moment in the facilities that were referred to. Thank you.
Any further questions or inputs from the ANC?
Thank you, Chair. Good afternoon, everyone. Let me also welcome the presentation that explained in depth as to what the organizations have been dealing with under the state of emergency. But let me just maybe expand from what Member Dagmore has asked in relation to the PPEs in general, not necessarily on the mask, whether there were any organizations that were sponsored with the PPEs, and to what extent has that affected the effectiveness of the seniors in those establishments. And then the second one, Chair, is around the support given to senior citizens who might be affected by COVID-19. To what extent has the department assisted in terms of the dementia that was explained here and other frustrations that they may have encountered during the period of the COVID-19? And of course, from what Member Bosman asked about the 350s, do we have a collection of those people who applied but did not get positive results or positive outcomes? From those who received, did they receive for the months that have gone past? Because now some people are receiving the 350s for the second and the third time, whereas there are those who have not even received. Is there a commitment made that the tranche that is a balance will be paid to them in due course? Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Lakham. And I'll move to the Good Party.
Chairperson, I have no further questions. Thanks.
Thank you. I then move to the Freedom Front Plus.
Thank you so much, Chair. I want to start off by saying no state that cannot care and look after its elderly and its disabled people deserve their respect and their loyalty when the very people are young still. So we're going to look after these people. And I think that the backbone of our health and social service today we heard is not the governing party in the Western Cape, but the NGOs. They are the real heroes. What I heard here, I'm so filled with emotion to see what they are doing, and then they still must come here and say they have financial challenges. Why should they have financial challenges? Why must they wonder what the new service level agreement will look like? They're going to know. We're going to make it possible for them to function and do whatever they are doing it even better than what they're doing now. And I also want to ask all these organizations of that food parcels, how many did you get from SASSA? How many did you get from the city of Cape Town? I see it's donations. Who gave the donations? The people, if you are old, you turn to God. but they're not allowed to have gatherings, church gatherings. Has this been brought to the attention of the Premier? Has he raised it at national level? I would like to know these issues. Is there a uniform message to old people in terms of the COVID-19? Because we are flip-flopping all the time. Every time a minister appears on TV, I say, yes, it's coming. He's going to change his mind or her mind and going to change whatever he decided. So when you see social distancing and no visitors allowed to older people, what are you doing to these people? Is that a cure? They are old. Some of them might be 80 and they can't get visits. Can't you have a shield between them and the visitor like we have in the banks, like we have at supermarkets or at pharmacies? Why are they not allowed social visits? I'd like to know that. And I'd like to know if you are giving the Western Cape government a list of your needs post-COVID. Because as I understand it, the DA has a recovery plan, which we haven't seen yet. And in that recovery plan, they should make provision for your needs post-COVID, because that recovery plan must also be a recovery of all these NGOs who gave here evidence before us. I don't know all their names, but I got some of them. But CEDA, and I got the other organizations that gave CPOA. I want them to submit to this committee their urgent needs post-COVID so that we can include it in the recovery plan envisaged by this government. Thank you.
Thank you very much, members. There were some general questions was to the majority of organizations. So if there are any organizations that would like to respond, I believe that I incorrectly said that there were no participants left from the WCOPF, but I believe that we have Ms. Dyries on the line. I don't know if we can perhaps start with you to respond to the first question. I think you're on mute. There we go. I think you're on mute.
Oh, okay, I'm trying.
No, we got you. We got you.
Have you got me?
Yes.
Can you hear me?
We can hear and we can see you.
I would just like to respond to the DA about the stats. When we were collating this, about when I had the focus group with the managers from the centers, we did not really ask them for the stats because we didn't have a long time to collect all the evidence, but however we can get that. And we can forward it to them if we do get the email address. And then to the ANC, did we receive additional funding? We did not ask for additional funding because we're not direct service providers. We are actually a lobbying advocacy organization, but however, we are looking at how we are going to respond with future business plans with the DSD to see how we can incorporate this response to the COVID-19 pandemic in our business plan. But yeah, we don't have a problem with not getting extra funding because we didn't request the money that we weren't using, which we would have normally used to bring people to meetings and things like that. We were able to utilize that money, you know, to do what we, in our response with the data for members for Zoom meetings. And so, yeah, we will incorporate our response and what we want to do with the challenge with the COVID-19 in our new business plan. And hopefully it will be approved.
Thank you. And then I see Christine.
Thank you, Chair. I'm not going to respond on all the issues raised, just a couple of highlights. Honourable Cameron, I think our challenges is beyond masks. It's also full PPE. Normally, you will have a certain basic level of PPE, and if an infection occurs, you require full PPE. We're currently busy, and I hope to have the results next week. busy with an assessment at all of our essential services facilities to assess what they have and what they will need for a period of at least 3 months. So I unfortunately cannot answer the exact detail. Should you require it, I can make it available to the committee. To the FF Plus, thank you for taking up our plea, but I must also try and balance it out and put some context. If you watch the news, and tonight there will on the news insert some serious discussions, and again Monday morning, about what is happening nationally in terms of the decreased levels of funding in other provinces, as well as the very weak administration of subsidies, which in some cases resulted in organizations not getting their subsidies for 3 to 6 months. In the Western Cape, and I gave credit to the department, that gave us lots of assurance. They maintained our subsidy levels, who for me was okay for now, and we regularly, with the agreed to frequency, received our funding. I do agree with you in terms of the recovery plans. I am exceptionally worried. We heard about possible retrenchments. I think within the next month or two, BDISA will have to look at that too. And in most cases, the speakers, the NGO speakers of today, has a proud history over decades of building up expertise of social welfare infrastructure of experience. And if we do not work on a sustainable recovery plan already as we in this crisis, it is bound to happen that we will lose it. The Western Cape will lose it, and it will take us 2 to 3 decades to recover to the level where we are at now, at this stage. That is only my input at this point in time. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any other organizations that would like to make an input? Age in Action or the CPOA or APD or RCFF? Yeah. Any of you like to make any inputs to the questions?
Sorry, Chairperson.
Is that a point of order?
Yeah, it's a point of order. Can the previous speaker just indicate, because I've asked a very simple question, whether in addition to the funding, there were additional funds given. So the first speaker explained clearly no, because they are an advocacy group. The second speaker did not respond to the question. I'd like a response. Did they receive extra funding, yes or no?
Chairperson, we did not.
Thank you.
Thank you. Then I see Irene Snell-Carroll.
Yes, I can just respond in terms about additional funding. We haven't received as an organization additional funding from the Social Development for specifically COVID-19. But as I stated, funding that we luckily had, we use that to assist, but as it ran out very quickly. So unfortunately, we just, from now on, I don't know what's going to happen forward, but there is a need for assistance and a crying out from communities for specifically, and not only masks, etc., but specifically in terms of food assistance. Thank you.
Thank you. Is that a point of order, Honourable Murray?
Thank you, lady. Thank you so much. No, I also didn't get a reply. I asked, did they get any food parcels from SASSA? And how many? Because I heard here that one of the participants here says they had 320 cooked meals and 592 food parcels.
Okay, we're not going to reopen the question round. I'll just ask the organisations.
No, that was a question I asked already.
Yes, exactly.
And they didn't reply if they received
food parcels. Okay, so I'll ask if they can then reply to your questions on the food parcels from SASSA. I have somebody named Governance. I'm not sure who that is.
It's Elmin Grobler, Western Cape APD.
Thank you. Please proceed.
I can just confirm that neither have our organization received any funding from the department with regards to the COVID. And then we also have not received any food parcels or our branches. There's 27 branches over the Western Cape have not received any food parcels from SASSA. The 592 food parcels in our statistics is food parcels received from communities or sponsorships that our social workers then made food parcels of, or cooked meals that was given to the clients, to persons with disabilities.
Great. Thank you very much. That then concludes this part of the meeting. I would like to thank all of the organizations for all of the tremendous work that you're doing in assisting the most vulnerable in society. Thank you very much for coming to speak to our committee today. And thank you for those presentations and all the thought that you've put in and answering our questions. We're very grateful to have a much better understanding of the work that you're doing, as well as the challenges surrounding the pandemic and more generally. Members will likely want to engage with you again. We might write to you with some questions, or as noted by the chair of the Social Development Committee, you might see us again. We hope to see you again. So thank you very much for that. We now conclude this portion of the meeting. I think we should take a 5-minute leg stretch break, and we will return at exactly 4 o'clock for the second part of the meeting on bereavement counselling and psychosocial support. So if members would please stay on the line. I see Dr. McDonald.
Thank you, Chair. Just a quick note to say that if the committee would like the list of the organizations that we did provide additional COVID funds to for the old age homes and disabled homes, we can provide that list to the committee.
Thank you. That's very helpful. I think we will add that as one of our requests for information at the end of the meeting. All right. So
Chair, if I could just ask, we'd welcome that information and the detail.
Yes, Honourable Doug, we'll look at that when we do our committee deliberations. We're now going to put the meeting, we're going to suspend the meeting until 4 o'clock. Thank you very much. Good afternoon, and we're back. It is now 4 o'clock. We've just had a very brief break. We're going to now start the second part of our meeting, which is regarding bereavement counselling and psychosocial support initiatives during this COVID-19 pandemic. We're going to start with the Departments of Social Development and Cultural Affairs and Sports. I see we do have Minister Fernandez on the line now. I don't think we have Minister Murray on the line yet, but I do say a very warm welcome to both departments, and we'll hand over to you directly. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I don't know if the Minister wants to say anything first before I start the presentation.
Thank you, Dr. MacDonald. Good afternoon, Chairperson, honourable members, officials and guests. My apologies. I had attended a national MINMEC headed by Minister Lindiwe Zulu. And all I can say is that the future looks very, very bleak, having just listened to some of the closing remarks before I joined. But I will immediately hand over to Dr. MacDonald to present on behalf of DSD. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Minister Fernandez. I'll hand over to you, Dr. MacDonald.
Sorry, just a point of order, Chair.
What is your point of order, Honourable Doug Moore?
Chairperson, we generally have if we have an input from the MEC, then there's an opportunity to ask some questions. I just find it astounding that the MEC talks about a bleak future, doesn't explain why. I think it would be really appreciated if the MEC could explain what concerns her, because obviously if she has concerns, she should convey those to us, but she gives no details. So could we just ask the MEC to elaborate on that statement?
Okay, thank you, Minister. Could you very briefly elaborate on that statement before we move towards the presentation?
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson. In response to the Honourable Doug Moore, my concerns are not new concerns. They are concerns regarding disability.
This on the wrong screen. Someone's sharing the screen. Please stop sharing.
May I proceed, Chairperson?
Thank you. Again, we've got please stop sharing. Okay, there we are. All right. Minister, please
thank
proceed.
Thank you, Chair. So, as you know, the National MINMEC is 9 provinces and the National Minister. And the issues that were raised were that of SASA, the 350 SRD grant, the disability grants for February and March that has not yet been paid, the fact that all the persons with disabilities were told to apply for a 350 SRD grant. And then I think the announcement that certain announcements were made, but they were not signed off by Treasury. And so now there's going to be some backpedaling. I will wait for the minute of that meeting, and then I will be in a better position to share. But I think a lot of our actions were premised on the fact that there was going to be funding from National Treasury for food relief and all sorts of additional support during COVID. And it does not seem as if that will materialize in the next 4 to 6 weeks. So from a humanitarian perspective, as a province, we are going to have to bat. And you might know that in some other provinces, payments were suspended during COVID-19. And I think there is a rushing around. I also believe that there is a court matter where 8 other provinces were cited and only the Western Cape was not cited because we continued with our TPAs to all our stakeholders throughout COVID. But the fiscal situation is dire. And everyone is appealing. I know the minister has said she has gone to National Treasury for funding, but it doesn't seem at this stage as if the funding for the food relief will materialize. I pick up from the comments that were made by the Honorable Gillian Bosman, Member Doug Moore, and Member Peter Murray, regarding support. And so we can only work with what it is we have. And as I said, the challenges are huge. The relationship with SASA needs to be built or rebuilt. And the breakdown between SASA and the South African Post Office took up quite a bit of our time. So the discussions have been quite lengthy. And this is why I thought it appropriate to just say that. I think it would be remiss of me not to alert the honourable members and our guest to the fact that funding is going to be put under even more pressure going forward based on the current information received today. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you very much, Minister. We'll now proceed with the presentation. Thank you very much.
Can everybody see the screen?
We can. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much, Chairperson. We've been requested to do a presentation on the psychosocial and bereavement support that has been rendered during the COVID-19 disaster by the Western Cape government. So we've provided a joint presentation between the two departments. I think the key thing to emphasize is that psychosocial support is tailored to the specific needs of clients. So it will include a range of interventions ranging from debriefing, counseling, psychotherapy, cognitive behavioral therapy, and so forth. And its aim is to develop the coping mechanisms and resilience of the client and or family unit. So the presentation that we have is covering both departments. In the context of the COVID-19 national disaster, the Provincial COVID Coordinating Council determined that DSD should take on the role of providing psychosocial support to individuals or families affected in various ways by the COVID disaster. I think in that sense, we would say that the bulk of the services were rendered by either the Department of Social Development's professionals, or by NGOs that are funded by the Department of Social Development. So the Provincial COVID Coordinating Council further determined that DCAS, the Department of Cultural Affairs and Sport, should take the lead in engaging the religious sector to strengthen bereavement support to families who had lost members to COVID-19, and a religious sector or faith-based organization forum was established, which the Department of Cultural Affairs and Sport, as well as the Department of Agriculture, Minister Mayor, been engaging with on a weekly basis, as well as the Minister of Social Development and other government officials on this issue, among others. On the 11th of May 2020, the Departments of Health and Social Development agreed to a protocol whereby DSD would assist with counselling to persons referred by the Department of Health to quarantine and isolation facilities, and also counselling and or reintegration and or mediation services when persons return to their families and communities following hospitalisation or quarantine or isolation. And the main need here related to overcoming stigma and fear around the return of previously infected individuals. And this proved to be quite a challenging area of work. During the disaster period, psychosocial support services were also required for a range of related vulnerabilities that occurred or were aggravated by the COVID-19 situation. Some examples of that would be gender-based violence and domestic violence cases, trauma, depression, anxiety, and of course, some of the issues that I mentioned earlier as well, the loneliness and so on, that are affecting individuals who were locked in their homes or in facilities without visitors. So a quick overview of the number of persons reached in total. There were 45,900 people reached with the support services to individuals and families, which included debriefing services, telephonic one-on-one counseling and support services, as well as trauma counseling and support, mostly done telephonically because of the lockdown requirements that prevented quite often the being one-on-one contact. And then at the same time, we've also been rendering additional services to victims of gender-based violence. And there are the details of those services, but I think we've also covered this in the other presentation to the committee before. So there has been quite a lot of demand for these services during the lockdown period, which and the shelters have been required quite a lot of additional new admissions. Although we have still managed to ensure that they were able to take everyone that needed help. Then in terms of bereavement support, the Department of Cultural Affairs has had a partnership with the religious sector and really worked to scale up the ministry and support to families in need, and has been offering bereavement support linked to funerals. There's the task team that I mentioned earlier, which we meets on a regular basis to coordinate this work. And I think that, you know, we must emphasize that this disaster has been bigger than any one department or any one agency, and has really required all different groupings in society to take hands. The launch of the enriched web portal, as well as a resource portal for after-school NGOs and sport practitioners, has also been developed so that they can also be a source of support in communities. And then focusing residents on the importance of support with a call for a minute of silence at noon every Wednesday in memory of all those who've lost their lives and loved ones to COVID-19. And this was the graphic that was used to draw attention to that initiative. So that is the overview. Obviously, there's a lot more information than that, but we wanted to keep it within time frames. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Dr. McDonald. We had asked the departments to keep it brief, so thank you very much for having done that. We now have two organisations that we're going to hear from. The first is Lifeline Western Cape, and I believe we have Glynis Depper on the line.
You do. Hello.
Can Hello. You hear me? Yes, loud and clear. You're welcome to put on your camera if you like.
I just have.
There we are. Okay. Thank you very much for joining us. Over to you.
All right. Just to give you a bit of a background on Lifeline Western Cape, we've been around for 52 years. We offer a free counselling service by means of a landline, WhatsApp, and our face-to-face facility has had to be closed down due to COVID. We're hoping to open up shortly. But in the meantime, we've brought in a Zoom system. And all in all, we are receiving over 3,000 calls a month. Listening to the former speaker, we actually haven't had bereavement via COVID calls that much. What we've had are gender-based violence. We've had more psychosocial issues that have come up because people are not distracted anymore by the busyness of life and work, etc. And what we found is that old stuff, if I may put it that way, is rearing its head. So if somebody is prone to sort out their problems by being angry, the anger is overwhelming them. And then they phone into us and say, I'm so angry, I don't know how to deal with it. I'm actually hitting my wife. Our approach is to try to make the person feel as safe as possible and find some resources within them that they weren't aware of. We like to think of ourselves as a very important form of counseling where we do not judge. It's very difficult for us. There's a cost for us psychologically, as you can imagine, because we have to put our feelings to one side. As far as bereavement is concerned, the bereavement that we are looking at is loss of employment, loss of family interaction, loss of a sense of predictability, loss of control. And those are that's the form of bereavement that we are attracting at the moment. We're also noticing a trend that online counselling and texting is I don't like to use the word popular, but if you know what I'm trying to say, it is the most popular way of contacting Lifeline at the moment. And I guess that's because people are trapped in a house with their abuser and cannot speak. So we are looking at expanding online counselling very much post-COVID. What is the most used facility that we have is WhatsApp, because everybody has got WhatsApp. Not everybody has Zoom and not everybody has internet, but everybody's got WhatsApp. And our WhatsApp line is ringing off the hook with texts and phone calls. I'm just wondering if there are any questions that anybody would like to ask, because we cover a vast array of issues that are coming up. And I'd like to mention also, we're in demand for trauma debriefing. There's a lot of, as we're all aware of, there's a lot of violence going on, and Lifeline has a specific team that can go out. We've got a call the other day for 6 people who had witnessed the rape of a child, and we've sent our team out there to deal with that. And that's it in a nutshell. I'm wondering if there are any questions that could help me explain possibly more specifically what we do.
Thank you very much. We will have a round of questions, but we're going to have one more input from Jelly Beans first.
Cool.
Okay. I just want to see if that's... no, that's all right. All right, so we have Edith Creel from Jelly Beans on the line. Good afternoon and welcome. I'll hand over to you.
Hi there. So thank you very much for the opportunity, especially so late on a Friday afternoon. Are you able to see my presentation?
Yes, we can. Thank you so much.
Okay, great. So in just to give you...
Full color.
Oh, brilliant. So just to tell you a little bit about Jelly Beans, we're a very small organization with big dreams. We work with children who've been traumatized, abused, and neglected, in terms of providing therapeutic services to children and their families, for, you know, as a result of the trauma. The majority of children that are referred to us are children who have been sexually abused. Unfortunately, in some ways, sexual abuse is still seen as the worst form, or the worst form of abuse, and of course it is bad, but so is neglect, physical abuse, etc. So we provide therapeutic services to all children from 0 to 18. We provide training and mentoring for professionals in the field, lay counselors, people in communities, small groups in communities regarding child protection and child mental health issues. And then we're also very involved in developing resources. So that would be booklets, pamphlets, social media campaigns to inform people of, or to improve service delivery to children. As I said, we are a small organization. We currently have a staff complement of 5.5 people. And unfortunately, we have just had to retrench our secretary, which has now resulted in us having to take on more administrative tasks. So in a nutshell, that's Jelly Beans. I think it would be pertinent to start off with looking at what is the pandemic that we're dealing with. And Dr. Bruce Perry speaks about the real crisis of this pandemic is not necessarily the next 6 months, but it really is what are we going to do with the social and emotional toll that this is having on individuals and families who will remain the most marginalized for the next 6 decades. The trauma that our children and our families are experiencing now is something that will carry on through their lifetime in some shape or form and potentially be passed on to their families. And we refer to this as intergenerational trauma. So it's really important for us to think about, yes, we are in a crisis now, we are in a state of emergency, but that's not going to go away when COVID decides to you know, not be so prolific, or we find a vaccine, this is really something that affects children developmentally, cognitively, emotionally, and will so for the next six decades. So what is very obvious also to us is that the COVID pandemic adds another layer of distress to our children who've already experienced high levels of complex and developmental trauma. So for a lot of our children, it's just another stressor, another type of trauma that they have to deal with. It's not, for many children, the most primary one, or the one at the forefront of, you know, the kinds of things, the kinds of stresses that they are experiencing. Thanks to Childline South Africa, I've added a couple of quotes from children themselves, and the kinds of things that children say we need to be aware of. I worry about my mom, she's in the hospital. So many people are dying and getting infected with the virus, I worry that everyone is going to die. Government should not allow the selling of alcohol because I think it is a bad idea, as people make bad choices when they are drunk. When they announced that there was to be a lockdown, I freaked out because I felt like it was the end of the world and we're all going to die, which is ironic since I'm home all day, every day, but now I feel trapped inside my house. Perhaps I'm claustrophobic. I think that they should check on children more regularly and make sure that when they talk to children, to allow children to give more honest answers, because most children are hurt and prefer to bottle up their emotions. And so they should be free to speak, because we do not know if they are being abused or if everything is okay at home or not. We don't also know how they are feeling. They should communicate more with children and visit them more often. So this was in a bigger part of a much bigger study where children gave their thoughts and feelings regarding the pandemic and in particular the lockdown. So since the beginning of the lockdown until now, some of the things that we've become aware of in terms of the children that we work with is that there's been an increased exposure to violence in the home. So GBV is not just something that happens to predominantly women, but children very often are the witnesses of the kind of domestic violence that is happening. And I think that that part of GBV is not getting recognized in terms of really looking at how to help families get through these kind of crises. Interestingly, like the previous speaker, we've had few referrals related to COVID specifically, and sexual abuse is still the majority of the kinds of referrals that we're getting. So we are getting more referrals, but the majority still being sexual abuse. So what that's telling us is that children are vulnerable in their homes, and we also see that children are sexually abusing other children during this time of lockdown. Many children are traumatized by what's happening at community level. So for instance, witnessing the army being violent with a community member, but there's very few psychosocial services for children to access and to help them deal with the kinds of things that they're seeing. So for children, as I mentioned, the pandemic may be just another thing to deal with. But what we have to understand is that it has a significant impact on the neurobiological functioning and the development of the brain. It's not just about, okay, it's just another thing. It really is a significant thing in terms of how children function. And interestingly, how they are going to go back to school and how the Department of Education is going to deal with that. And that we don't forget that we can't teach children who are in a state of trauma. So we have to pay attention to that first before children can start to learn. A lot of children didn't get appropriate information. I know that there has been a lot of campaigns to share information, but interestingly, you know, a lot of children do not have access to, you know, online platforms. And so they still don't quite understand what it is that this is all about. And sometimes the information given to children is also not very helpful for them. So people would explain to children, for instance, that the germ jumps from one person to another. Now, when you're 4 or 5, and you think about a germ jumping from one person to another, you know, isn't there a better way that we could be explaining this to children that's not so scary? We've seen an increase in anxiety. A lot of children are worried about illness or death of themselves or a loved one. You know, going to school and I pick up the virus, coming home and I make my granny sick and my granny dies. So that's a huge anxiety for children. We've seen a lot of children become very withdrawn and shut down during the lockdown. So they've really kind of closed themselves off quite significantly. Some children, of course, have also had very difficult behaviors that parents have had to manage, which has been very difficult, particularly when service delivery has been very, very limited. Homeschooling has been very problematic for children and families, and I think it's led to a lot of violence in homes between parents and children. The opening and closing of the schools also on an emotional level has been very difficult for children because, you know, there's no routine. There's no way of them settling into a routine, which is significantly important for children. Many of our children are left unsupervised or neglected. And we also see that the level of stress in parents is particularly high, which of course has a knock-on effect because children are often the ones that the stress is taken out on in terms of emotional or physical or even sexual abuse. In terms of service delivery, what we need to consider is how do children access child protection services during lockdown? So if I'm a child, how do I say something's going on? I can't go to church, I can't go to school, I can't go maybe to my aftercare program where there might be a safe person to talk about the violence that's happening in my home. So even adults struggle to get help during lockdown. What about our children? We need more hands on the ground in the communities. We saw during lockdown pockets of excellence, yet unfortunately a lot of services were inaccessible regarding child protection issues, and that made it significantly difficult. Interesting also that somebody commented on the fact that we've been able to place all people that were in need of shelters in shelters, and we've unfortunately not had that experience. What I found also is that service delivery depended a lot on the motivation and commitment of individual people. So, you know, we've had some amazing social workers who've done amazing things in the middle of really stressful situations. And then we've had some social workers who've delivered a significantly poor service, you know, and that's been very, very stressful for us, you know, in terms of protecting children. I think also in terms of communication between government and the NPO sector, I think there have been some, again, pockets of excellence, but there have been some aspects that have been difficult to, you know, where there's been little communication. So, for instance, in terms of food distribution. So again, somebody commented on the fact that, you know, there wasn't, we received no food parcels, for instance, from DSD, no extra funding. You know, we made plans, and I'm very proud to say that we did. But I think that maybe if there had been a little bit more communication around some of those things, it may have been helpful. So the next two slides really focus a lot on what it was that we were up to during the lockdown. So as social workers, we are essential services. And as far as I'm concerned, even in the middle of the pandemic, we are a service that cannot stay at home. We have to be out there helping the people because that's where the crises are happening. So within the first 3 weeks of lockdown, we were back at the office sharing out food parcels, seeing children for sessions and parents where it was significantly needed. We did do Zoom sessions and online sessions, but particularly with children, younger children, that's exceptionally difficult. You know, not being able to work with them face to face. Children don't do well, that might either younger children, in terms of technology. We participated in various different task teams around child protection issues. We were involved in radio broadcasts, involved in helping others to get to the appropriate reporting services because they were so limited. We have done quite a bit of training also around this, looking at online and telephone counselling. We worked with the NACCW and the Children's Institute to put together training program for childcare workers. We've also developed a booklet for communities regarding COVID and child protection and child mental health. I've mentioned the social media campaign. We've put together training programs for educators, presented webinars. So this was an international webinar we were asked to present, which was very well attended, for which we were very excited. We've developed therapeutic stories for children to help them manage some of their fears and the realities of COVID, and for instance, hospitalization. We have spent quite a bit of time consulting with other colleagues who've needed support in terms of making decisions in terms of child protection and also in terms of child mental health issues. And lastly, we are busy compiling a booklet for frontline workers on what we refer to as psychological first aid. Social workers will not necessarily be the first line of defense or the first people that children see. It may be a nurse, it may be a church member. And most significantly, my sense is that our teachers are going to have the most significant role in terms of being those frontline workers. So in terms of some closing thoughts,
thank you.
We anticipate increased disclosures of abuse once the schools reopen, because school is often a safe place for some children. What's been challenging, and we need to really think about when we're working with traumatized children, is that they rely on nonverbal communication as a way of keeping themselves safe. And wearing masks hides a lot of your nonverbal communication. And this is very distressing to children because they are on constant alert because they can't quite read your body language. Teachers are going to need support, and they need to be trained in terms of managing the emotional impact of the pandemic, because we just do not have enough hands on the ground in terms of working with all the children who have all to some extent been adversely affected. We need to train frontline workers and community leaders in terms of psychological first aid. There has already been and will continue to be an increase in the number of children who need to access psychological services. And from my point of view, we need more hands on the ground in terms of dealing with child protection and child mental health in communities. And the social work services are already stretched to such capacity that we need to be creative in terms of looking at the possibility of using people who are in communities to be providing some basic services. Staff, social workers, therapists who are working in the arena, I'm thinking particularly of my staff, need emotional support. The lady from Lifeline mentioned how difficult it is to be sitting listening to traumatic experiences. And I think one of the things that's been interesting for me is that we're dealing with trauma every day pre-COVID, but now we have a level of desperation in children and families that we haven't had to deal with before. So there's an increase in the kinds of trauma and the kinds of desperation that families come to us for. And then lastly, the issue of funding has been mentioned by some of the other people, and this is a reality for us, having already had to retrench one of our staff members. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mrs. Creel, for your inputs. We want to say thank you very much to the departments and the two organizations for this very essential work that is very much needed, especially during this time of the pandemic. I'm now going to hand over to the members to see if they have any questions. How it works is that we'll give each party, of which there are four represented here currently, we'll give each party 3 minutes. If you would just indicate to which organization your question corresponds, and then if the organizations and department would just take a note of the questions, and we'll respond right at the end. So let's start with the DA as usual. Are there any questions from the DA?
Thank you, Chair. Yes. I'd also like to echo what you have just said to the organizations who's doing the frontline services in our communities. My question is to both to Lifeline, but also to DSD. We are, as families, we are, as you know, death is as important as life within our families. So when one of our families die, we have a certain way of saying our final goodbyes. And COVID has now forced us to do it differently without being prepared to do it differently. So I just want to know, in terms of saying our goodbyes, has Lifeline or DSD evaluated how this new norm can possibly contribute in further manifesting dysfunctional, manifesting in dysfunctional families, and aggravate GBV and domestic violence? That is my first question. And then I'd like to ask, and this is specifically now to DSD, in regards to the numbers that they are quoting. I want to understand your debriefing to families, the numbers that you are quoting, and you say number of clients, and you say the months that you have seen these clients. How does the sessions manifest either to an individual or to family? How does it manifest within these numbers? And if you can give a breakdown of sessions that you have had, or clients that you have serviced rather, metro versus rural. And that also goes for the telephonic one-to-one counseling. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honourable Boerter. Are there any questions from the ANC, please? Honourable Dougmore.
Thank you very much once again for the presentations and for the work being done under very difficult circumstances. Firstly, just in regard to Lifeline, we understand the explanation that, you know, the office has not been able to operate, and that you're doing things telephonically and using a WhatsApp. I just wanted to know, how many staff members do you actually have that are able to deal with the engagement via WhatsApp? Because I can imagine that it's quite time intensive, you know, when he's responding to particular issues, doing referrals. So I'm very interested to know what staff complement do you have specifically working on the WhatsApp advice system, because it sounds from what you explained that it's actually one of your staff members dealing with an individual person who's calling in. It's just not a standardized WhatsApp response. And then I was also encouraged to hear that you indicated that in some cases you actually have a team that is able to go out into the community and deal with a particular situation. So I also just wanted to have a sense of what is the staff complement available to Lifeline to do that kind of work, where you actually require a direct visit to a particular community. So those were two questions that I'd had for Lifeline. And then in regard to the department, I'm not sure, because it seems that DCAS is the main department, you know, working with the religious and faith-based organizations. I just wanted to get a sense, if anyone can give us a sense, are we talking here about the organized and traditional as well as charismatic churches? Could we just get a sense of who actually participates in the forum? Is it on a voluntary basis, or is it sort of, say, organized traditional churches such as, like, say, the Anglicans or the Dutch Reformed Church or the Jewish Community or the MJC? Do they participate as organizations, or is it individual churches who just volunteer to be part of this particular forum that's been set up? So I'd just like to get a sense of the composition of the faith-based forum that has been set up to assist with the bereavement counseling. And is that the same forum that has been referred to previously that Dr. Ivan Mayer is involved in, or is this a totally different forum? Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Dougmore. Are there any questions from the Good Party?
No, thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Freedom Front Plus, Honourable Murray.
Thank you so much, Chair Lady. I want to tell Lifeline, you are a household name in the Western Cape, everybody knows Lifeline. You are most well-trained organization I can think of for counseling. So, have you been in consultation with the Department of Social Services? Did they call on your services? Are you in direct contact with them? Do you cooperate with them? Are you at all interested in being part of the formulation of a recovery plan? Because I see that you know what all the problems are, because people phone you and you counsel them. And then I'd like to know what reasons were given to you by phone-ins about their anger management. Why did they beat their wives? Because they're angry. And then also, I want to say we cannot operate in silos. Jelly Bean, Ms. Creel, you talk about children that's been sexually abused. You talk about training and mentoring with child protection and mental health sector. Did they come to the party? Did they say that, listen, how can we help you in doing your work even better? We have a medium-term expenditure framework budget. And you just told us now that what are we going to do over the next 6 decades about individuals and families that has been traumatized and put in a very bad position because of COVID-19. I would like to know what your ideas on this. And I would also like to know your national advocacy task team that you mentioned about, told us about. This, who are they, the National Advocacy Task Team? Are there any linkages between them and our council or command centers, provincial or national? Any linkages there? Or are you just operating on your own? Although you sit with all the expertise and knowledge and volunteers, has anybody taken your hand? I'd like to know, have they taken your hand? Department of Social Services, Department of Health, have they consulted with you about what should be included in regulations that would affect the type of work you are doing? Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Marie. I'll then hand over to Lifeline and Jelly Beans to respond to those questions. Should we start with Lifeline?
Hi, yes. Okay. Where to start? The question about deaths caused by COVID and what do we do? And please interrupt me if I've misinterpreted the question. It was a bit of a while back. What do we do with people who have no sense of closure due to the restrictions of lockdown? And that's a hard question to answer, because what do we do? They will approach us at Lifeline, and we will try to walk them through the closure that they need. It's quite a difficult question to answer in a kind of routine, detailed way, because everybody is unique. Our way of counseling is to reach right inside the person and find out who they are and what their coping mechanisms are and what their conditioned responses are, and walk with them. And it may take up to 3 hours and a repeat session or more. But that is the way that Lifeline, with all humility, would approach someone who has had no closure. And I think it doesn't only pertain to COVID-related bereavement. There's a whole lot of people out there who have no closure. But I don't know if that answers your question. But that's what we would focus on, is walking through, walking alongside that person and going through possibly phases of grief, etc., and acknowledge what they are agonizing about, and hopefully bring some relief in some sense of personal closure. Does that kind of answer anything? Okay, and then the thing about WhatsApp, I think the question was, how many people do we have manning the lines? The total of our volunteer counsellors is about 80 to 90 people, and we all do WhatsApp, face-to-face, etc. We have a team of a trauma team of about 12 counsellors who have been specifically trained to do trauma debriefing. Right now, we don't go out to people. Hopefully that will happen in the future. We did pre-COVID, we did obviously go out. So we do Zoom sessions with people needing trauma debriefing. I can't remember what the face-to-face, the same thing with the face, we have a face-to-face team of 12 to 15 counsellors who are all rostered, and that we're doing via Zoom at the moment as well. Face-to-face counselling is much in demand, and we have a waiting list of about 2 weeks, which distresses us. Remembering we're all volunteers, and we need to expand our WhatsApp facility, and hey, that needs money, and we are largely self-funding, which is not easy for us at all. We have had to suspend our training courses, which is our financial backbone. We're now launching them via online, which is a huge challenge to us, and we're having to redesign, etc. And we're also concerned that we will lose the intimate nature of the depth of our courses, but we have to take the bull by the horns and go ahead with it and see what happens. Funding is a huge issue for us at the moment. Remembering that we are pride ourselves on our services being one of free of charge, and therefore we reach a huge diverse community, particularly as I said before via WhatsApp, and we are all volunteers, so we've all been specifically very rigidly trained, very rigidly selected to be invited into Lifeline. And thank you to the speaker who said that we are a household name. You know what? COVID happened suddenly. No, we haven't been able to partner with any of the governmental departments as yet. It would be nice. But I think we were thrown headlong into this crisis, and we just got on with whatever resources we had. We encourage partnership. We are actually entering into a partnership with an NGO called Kids to Kids, which may interest Jellybean, where we will be taking on the parents and the teachers, and I think Childline Western Cape will be looking at the children. Anger management, there was a question about that. Why are people angry? You know, I think if you have been conditioned, or you've been a child with parents who are abusing each other, or there's anger in the house, that becomes your way of dealing with conflict. And when there are, as I said before, no distractions around you, like having to get up and go to work, whether, you know, you've lost your job, how are you going to respond to that? You're going to be angry. So what Lifeline tries to do is go back to the beginning of the anger. What happened to you? Who taught you to deal with conflict with anger? And it actually works wonders. Once people can actually point a finger at, this is why I am making the choice that I make. In other words, I'm going to just beat somebody up rather than go and talk to them. I believe we are making great strides in diffusing anger, because angry people are sad people. It's a secondary emotion. And once that is pointed out, so what are you frightened of by being vulnerable? Who taught you to be this tough dude, you know? Because if I cry in front of you, then I'm going to be vulnerable. And once you've pointed that out and walked somebody through that journey, there's a shift. And I hope I'm not sounding too romantic, but trust me, it really does work. Yes, and as I said, we would really like to form partnerships. There's such a need out there, and it's important that we all do join together and meet that need rather than work in quote, my, the former speaker, in silos. Thank you. If there's anything else, ask me, and I'll try my best.
Thank you very much for that. I just want to alert the committee that we have 10 minutes left for this meeting, and we do have some brief deliberations to get through. But I would like to invite Jelly Beans if there are any additional inputs.
Yes, thank you very much. So in terms of our relationship with the Department of Social Development, they provide subsidies and financial support to the services that we provide, and they have been the backbone of these services for a significant amount of time. Unfortunately, one would always like to be able to expand, but I do want to say that the Child Protection Directorate within social services has been very supportive of the work that we do. In terms of training, we have been involved pre-COVID in doing some training. I'm hearing on the ground a lot of social workers saying they need more specific training now on trauma issues and how to help children who are experiencing trauma. But again, I just do want to reiterate, I don't think we have enough social workers to be doing this as well. We need to be start being creative. Then in terms of the national task team I referred to, it is not a formal task team, but it is a collection of non-profit organizations mainly who are meeting and giving input to various different people, but in particular to the Department of Social Development regarding issues of child protection, referral pathways, schooling, nutrition. So we definitely are in communication with the various different departments about the issues that we feel need to be raised on behalf of children.
Thank you. And then I see a hand from Jacqueline Bull.
Yes, thank you. Just to answer Honourable Dagmore's question on behalf of DCAS, unfortunately, Minister Murray isn't with us because she's actually in the religious sector meeting right now. It is the same forum that Minister Mayor has spoken about. It's not a different forum. And it's a broad-based forum, including a number of the organized religious formations. And then a number of the individual churches and foundations linked to them are part of the humanitarian forum. So it has extended beyond just the formal organizations, but just to answer that question.
Thank you very much. All right, I think that then concludes the questions and answers. Guide me if it does not, members. Right, seems so.
Okay, I'd like to then. Are you asking if I have a piggyback question on Honourable Dagmore's question?
I don't think there's time for a round of follow-up questions, but of course there is the opportunity as always for questions in writing which we can submit to the organisations. It's just if one of the questions that you had asked had not been answered.
I submit myself to your rulings, Chair.
Thank you kindly, Honourable Murray. All right, I'd like to then thank both Departments of Social Development and Cultural Affairs and Sports for their presentation, as well as the inputs from Lifeline and Jelly Beans. And the committee extends its gratitude for the work that you do in the space, in this very difficult space, in these extremely difficult times. Thank you very much. The public engagement part of our meeting has concluded. The committee will deliberate on the meeting today. As I mentioned, members are welcome to submit any additional questions to any of the organizations or departments that were here today. If those could please be submitted by 12 o'clock on Monday, the 17th of August. I'm afraid we've run out of time for the consideration and adoption of the draft minutes. If the committee agrees, could those please stand over to our meeting next week?
Yes, Chairperson, I agree.
Thank you very much. Thank you. And then any resolutions or actions from this meeting? There was one which was to request the list of organisations that had received additional funding. Then Honourable Dougmore, I believe you had another item that you wanted to put under request for information or documents.
Yeah, thank you very much, Chair. It was just that in addition to the organisations, also the specific amounts that were allocated to those organisations, especially for the period of the lockdown. And then I appreciated the response of Jackie Bull to the question. If we could just have the details of the faith-based organisations that are participating, if we could just have that in writing, you know, who exactly is participating, also on the humanitarian subcommittee. I would just like to get a sense of which faith-based organisations are participating and whether that is interfaith and cuts across the various faith communities in our province. So the detail on that, thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honourable Dougmore. We've taken note and we'll send those requests through to the departments. I then see Honourable Buerta.
Thank you very much, Chair. And then my outstanding one on the number of clients, the metro versus rural breakdown.
Thank you. We have taken note of that as well to request that information. I then see Honourable Bosman.
Thank you, Chairperson. I just want to ask that the persons, organisations working with persons, of older persons, if they could send us a list of clients who were affected by trying to access grants from SASSA, and then also the organisations working with persons with disability, if they could give us a list, if they have one, of clients that are still struggling to access the temporary disability grant or their normal disability grant.
Great, thank you very much. Is that it, members? Thank you. Sorry, Honourable McKenzie, I did see your hand, my apologies.
Yes, if we can also, because we know at times, given the financial situation, that the departments can't give money all the time to organisations, what other support do they provide to NGOs or any organization during this time of COVID-19? Thank you.
Thank you very much. I see Honourable Nkondlo.
Thank you, Chair. A quick one, and expanding on Member Botta's question, if we can get from the NGOs and the department, what are some of the issues, especially from the hotspot areas? What are some of the children's related challenges, or what do they call cases that they received? What, just to understand the nature per hotspot area. Thank you.
We have noted that. Thank you very much, Honourable Nkondlo. All right, members, I thank you very much for your questions and for your collaboration for this meeting. We now come to the end of the meeting, and we will then see you on the 19th of August for our next meeting. Please stay safe and stay warm. The meeting is adjourned.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you.